Welcome to Jimmy Office Hours, where academics talk about academics. From the depths of liberal arts to the forefront of practical application, join us as we dive into critical discussions shaping the minds of tomorrow. Welcome to Jimmy Office Hours. My name is Scott Lloyd. I am an assistant professor of communication studies and a coach of speech and debate at the University of Jamestown, North Dakota. And Jimmy Office Hours is an opportunity for myself and my colleague, Jacob Bernard, to talk about issues surrounding liberal arts education and what we see on the horizon. And from time to time, I invite our colleagues to join in on the conversation. Jacob, how are you doing today?
Good. Yeah. So thank you for the introduction, Scott. I'm an assistant professor here at the University of Jamestown. I'm also the chair of the computer science department and director of online technology programs, so on and so forth. So I've got a few hats. We're hopefully simplifying that this summer. But I'm also a Jimmy alum, graduated in 2005. Had a few different majors here. I like to use my tenure here as a cautionary tale with my undergrad advisees. If you have four majors, you will be here 5 years. It's quite possible. It is a great time, but I got to learn a lot of different things through that. Additionally to that, did Student Senate as editor in chief of the Collegian for a year or so before finally graduating. And must have gone well, because eventually they did let me come back as a professor. So either that or the statute of limitations on undergrad shenanigans had expired.
Well, Jacob, I appreciate the opportunity. And by the way, this podcast was Jacob's idea. He approached me a few months ago about putting together a conversation around issues in liberal arts, because those of you that are following higher education, you know that across the board and across the nation, higher education is in a bit of transformation. And the way it looks compared to the way it looked like just a few years ago is changing dramatically. And that's where I want to start our conversation today, Jacob, with your field of computer technology. How does computer technology fit into the larger goals of a liberal arts education?
Scott, that's really a great question, because that's been some of the earliest literature on computer science education pertaining to the liberal arts. Articles dating back to the 70s have argued the same point. The most recent articles published this past year have argued the same point. How does computers fit into liberal arts? And so where do we kind of go with that is, well, what do we consider the liberal arts? What is our definition? The problem is every institution, every person has a slightly different understanding of what is liberal arts to them. What does it mean for me, my department, my institution? We follow that chain. So if we look at just the classic liberal arts, grammar, logic, let me see if I can name them all. Rhetoric, arithmetic, geometry, music, and astronomy. Verbal and mathematics. That is our classical definition of that. So if we think about, what is a liberal arts education, if we were to boil that down, that it's that broad base, right? We're getting a little bit of everything, so that no matter what you do when you leave our door, you can do anything you want. Have a successful, fulfilling life at whatever you choose to do or end up in. And so if we say, well, how does computers relate to that? Well, take any one of those classic liberal arts things and try to do it without technology.
Yeah.
So, which means technology and computing fits into everything else. But the inverse is also true. And that's a really exciting part about computer science or computer science education right now, is computer science is realizing that too. Oh, we've been around a little while. We're still kind of a junior discipline, newer kid on the block. But wait, music influences and probably always has, technology and how that's done, and mathematics and all of that. Well, okay. And then, but look at what's been in the news. What has been one of the most exciting things in the news? I don't know if exciting is the right word, hype, the whole AI thing.
Right.
cryptocurrency and AI. If you took the last 5 years and summarized what has been the, if we just ignore COVID for a minute, the exciting things in the news when it comes to technology, well, okay, how does those influence everything else? What is AI doing for you? Well, it's being that research companion, that hopefully helper for assignments and those sort of things. But it's becoming it's less programming and more working with technology, that it's made it more accessible to the average individual. You know, there's probably still plenty out there who are like, okay, I keep hearing AI, I don't know anything about it. But we're getting students coming in now to our classrooms, to our offices, and saying, hey, I tried this thing, regardless of what the topic is, that's being driven to, by technology. So we can't really divorce the two, which is also kind of good. But, you know, that debate's been around there. There's definitely different approaches in different places. How does computer science fit this? You know, we've debated in liberal arts a long time of, you know, simply business classes. Do those belong at a liberal arts institution? I think that argument's finally gone away and over. Students demanded, hey, we want to know more about that. Students have said that about technology. We've integrated those into our different programs. And so, yes, there's certainly different places at different institutions and those sort of things. I myself am amongst a group of faculty who were proponents that computer science in the liberal arts is best defined at that institution. What makes sense? Each institution, you know, we've got potentially different mission, different values, and those should drive what our courses and curriculum versus a specific set of thou shalt teach this.
Right.
Well, what makes sense for us? You know, take UJ, for example. What are some of the things we are very well known for or that we pride ourselves on regardless of what our program is? Well, our leadership courses, our education. And so whatever our discipline is, we make sure to incorporate aspects of that. So speech, do you work with your students to take leadership roles or leadership right. content in your classes? I'm willing to bet you do.
Yeah, absolutely. And you make a great point there about the integration of the liberal arts education into what we do here at UJ. And obviously rhetoric, speech is one of the founding disciplines of a liberal arts education going all the way back to Aristotle. But you make a great case for computer technology as well, because I often tell my students who are reluctant, right? A lot of times those speech classes, they put off to the last semester before they graduate because, you know, speech is always the number one fear in America, right above death. And so people are reluctant to practice those skills of public speaking. But what I tell my students is that no matter what your discipline might be, no matter what knowledge you have accumulated or what skills you possess, if you lack the ability to communicate those skills and that knowledge effectively to a variety of audiences in a variety of settings, then you are going to be face high difficulty in succeeding in the world as it is presently. And I think computer technology has the same sort of application. So much of what we do via communication has moved online. And there are differences in communicating online versus communicating face-to-face. And both have their pros and their cons. So students need to be well-versed in communicating in a variety of settings using a variety of technological tools to help them get their message across. And so that's when I have those students in the classroom, especially for public speaking, and they're like, you know, why do I have to take this course? Well, you need to take it because, several have pointed out, the inability to communicate in our present world highly truncates your ability to move forward with success. And so if you want to be successful, whether you measure success by a flourishing life or a well-rounded life, or if you measure success strictly in monetary value, all of that, you have to be able to communicate and communicate effectively to get that done.
Absolutely. And one of the biggest things that technology employers have come back and told the faculty here, University of Jamestown, has not been, well, why don't you teach a class on this technical topic? It's the so-called soft skills.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking about that the other day, back to, kind of where I got into teaching was, I'd worked at a large international company, aerospace company for many years. I kind of fallen into the report developer trainer guy, flying around the country, leading week-long training classes on how to be report developers. And I thought back to that, and I realized one of the things I kind of always said was, I could teach anybody the technical aspects. If they can't grasp why I'm doing this and how to gather that information and convey information to other people, we're wasting our time here. And so it's not the technical programming, the working with the tools. We can do any of that sort of thing. And it's been the same thing. I see that argument all the time online of, kind of goes maybe into one of your topics here down the road, but, just the general value of education is, well, what are we teaching y'all? Okay, well, that programming language, it's going to be out of date by the time you graduate in 4 years. You know what? It doesn't matter, because if we're incorporating all of those different elements of how to work with other people, how to do dreaded group work, those sort of things, that's what we're trying to, the how to learn and how to be a lifelong learner,
right,
is what we're hopefully imparting. But you mix those soft skills. It's funny you mentioned the different ways of communicating online, recognizing those differences, and then the generational differences, depending on the age of the person you're working with.
Right.
You send them a text message instead of calling them, they're going to be annoyed.
Mm-hmm.
However, you take somebody, Gen X or younger, and sure, you call them instead of texting them. Gen X, put that in an email. I want documentation.
Right.
But, I'll get back to you when I get back to you. Recognizing those differences, that can really change your tenure at a company.
Absolutely.
Oh, that's the annoying person who just always calls or wow, that person's fantastic to work with, I've always got notes, so on and so forth. Where the person might be pursuing the same level of competency, the same level of working. And so it's the bigger picture,
mm-hmm,
that we're conveying kind of with how we mix things. And so regardless of what your discipline and subject is, it's conveying that ability to learn.
I think you're exactly right. And I want to continue the conversation along the lines of, first, I want to ask you about your particular discipline,
yeah,
and how you see that evolving in the coming years. Certainly with AI, it's going to present some challenges. But how do you see the discipline of computer technology changing and adapting to the needs of students in the future? And then I want us to speak to the general understanding of liberal arts. Where do you see liberal arts going in the future? But let's start by talking about your discipline, first of all, in computer technology. What are some of the challenges that you see on the horizon? What are some of the changes that you and your colleagues are being confronted with right now? And how do you plan to meet the needs of a changing student constituency in the future?
Okay, well, the biggest short-term challenge right now, and I don't know if this is not necessarily a new challenge, but in fact, we can't even agree on where we're going right now.
Yeah.
So as a discipline, and what I mean by that is, you've got the CEO of NVIDIA, large hardware manufacturer, makes graphics cards and things like that, helps produce a lot of the computing power that powers all of the cool things that are coming out of, we're saying, nope, students won't even need a program in the future. We don't need to teach program anymore because computers can do it for us. We've got the opposite side of folks who are saying, we don't teach people to program. Wow, we're in big trouble when something actually breaks. And so figuring out what the next steps are is the big challenge right now. We've got amazing amounts of computing power, more than we've ever had. A lot of, you know, kind of the next step of technologies all coming to fruition right now. The possibility of true AI, I'm not saying necessarily sentience, robot overlords, maybe not quite yet. But if you think about transcripts, just simple audio transcripts, feeding those into a tool like ChatGPT, and you get something reasonable back, that's new. That's wildly. It irks me quite a bit. You know, 18 months ago, I was finishing up my dissertation. The level of accuracy with automatically generated transcripts 2 years ago, I spent a lot of hours manually re-listening and fixing those transcripts. Wouldn't have to do that now at all.
Right.
So what would that mean, though? That means spending my time somewhere else. So the whole concept of, well, if we're embracing that technology, how are we going to work with it? Will it change things? Will it shift things like jobs? Absolutely. Teaching, you know, writing and evaluating writing, it's shifting already. Where do we put our emphasis on? Programming. Is it possible that we can use AI tools to generate code? Absolutely. So evaluating code, we have to shift what we're doing there of, okay, no, show me that you can follow the logic of what's going on here. Say, you know, similar thing with an English essay. Can you follow the structure of what's been put together here? And so as a discipline, we're figuring out how to use that and where we're really going. You know, our computer is going to be more the wild animal that needs to be wrangled,
mm-hmm.
or the horse on the long cross-country trek that's your buddy the entire time. The more positive viewpoint is it's going to be our buddy going along, and whether you're the highly technical person or the please don't make me do much with the computer whatsoever, that ease of use is what makes us more willing to accept technology. So ease of use, and it makes sense to us and how we're using it. That's what I see us figuring out kind of in the short term and the long term, the continue to be that companion enhancing our lives, and whatever it is that we're working on is hopefully where we're going with things.
Do you see some bigger challenges with students coming into institutions of higher learning, specifically here at the University of Jamestown? I know that I've experienced this in my discipline. A lot of times when I give instruction about creating or generating some sort of speech, whether it's a persuasive presentation, an informative presentation, or just some sort of impromptu presentation where students are required to sort of speak extemporaneously off the top of their head. A lot of my students, what I'm experiencing with this generation that I haven't experienced in the past, at least not to this extent, is difficulty in being creative, in generating content from their experience. And I have a theory that perhaps this is due to a dependence upon Google and other search engines, where the imagination isn't being cultivated, at least to the extent that it was in the past, because first of all, we have all of this information at our fingertips. And so there's no need really to think or to engage the imagination in a creative fashion because all of this information exists.
Absolutely. I can kind of give two examples on that, but the summarization is our search tools have gotten really, really good. If you think about to the days of yore, you know, the Alta Vistas, Yahoo's, the early days of the internet, it took a lot of renditions and a lot of effort. You had to very, very carefully search what you put in that search string, quotes around this, plus this. And then, okay, first revision, I'm not finding what I was looking for. Second revision, so on and so forth. That careful structuring, and still maybe not even always finding what you, we had to continue thinking of a process. Right. What's the next step? Well, you type something into Google now, we're getting an interpretation. Mm-hmm. You scroll down Facebook, you're getting an interpretation of this is what you're probably looking for.
Right.
Which that's a side for it we can look at in a minute too. But these algorithms, search engines, tools like that have gotten really, really easy. An example for my discipline is we're learning in the last couple of years that we've really got to start being more aggressive in teaching file management. Students do no longer have a concept of, I store the file in my documents, I move it to my network drive, I copy the image over here. That this hierarchical way that we structure things on computers, the concept's gone.
Yeah.
Why? We save everything in one spot. We type search when we're looking for it. And most of the time, it shows up.
Mm-hmm.
It's tagged with a date or a file or something like that. So think about that in any context. How many phone numbers do you have memorized anymore?
Zero.
Right. Yeah. I've got a couple of my parents' phone number because it was mine growing up.
Yeah.
You know, I've got that one, my wife's number, my number. My son asked me last week, well, what's my phone number? I never bothered memorizing that one. You've only had the phone for a few months. So, but, you know, so the tools have gotten so good that you're absolutely, what happens when we hit a snake?
Right.
We go to Google. We search it. We don't. So I'm pretty confident to say that regardless of what your discipline is at an institution like ours, is figuring out how to come up with a process
mm-hmm.
is one of the things that we are all trying to cover in all of our classes. So, you know, whether you're a IT help desk person, okay, person says it's broke, you go back and forth, try to dig into what that means. What happens when your speech coach says, you need to rework on that and come back?
Right.
Hey, do I go to ChatGPT and say, write me a better speech?
Mm-hmm.
I could.
Yeah.
It's not going to get your point across, though, of what do you need to fix? And following that process to revise, expand, you know, maybe come to you and talk. Hey, right. Scott, what did I miss here?
Yeah.
And then that back and forth.
Exactly. You know,
so whether you're doing that with a broken computer or a speech that could use improvement, it's that back and forth, that process
mm-hmm.
that our tools have gotten so good that it's just not a flexed skill. It doesn't seem to be as much of a flexed skill. It's certainly not knocking K-12 or saying something's missing there. It's we lean on our tools. Yes, let's use this technology, but we're missing something in the process there too.
And I think this is where a liberal arts education is so helpful, because you're exactly right. The tools of technology have become so efficient that students can now go, or anyone can access this technology and then regurgitate very easily information. But there is a difference, and we all know this as educators, in regurgitating information and actually understanding the information and how to apply it in a variety of settings and circumstances. So
yeah, I've used that in class as the point of, look, when I'm grading this, what I want to see is you rub two brain cells together.
Mm-hmm.
I can look this information up myself. I want to see what idea you had.
Right.
And that's kind of the problem though with some of the tools is, We see like things like ChatGPT. You'll hear a lot of faculty really worried about it, things like that. And, you know, there's some to be worried about it. But to students, they don't see using it as something wrong. They right. simply see it as another tool. Oh, it's a different Google. I got an answer. Here's your answer you wanted.
Right.
And so that's what we got to focus on, really, the liberal arts, whether you're talking specifically computer science, history, whatever, is not what tool did you use, but what's the application? What's the next three steps after that?
Yes. And that's and the liberal arts, right? It teaches us to ask questions rather than always providing the right answer. And so technology gives us the right answers, but it doesn't help us in asking questions that lead to breakthrough, that leads to innovation and invention and new discoveries that progress humanity forward. And so when we think about reading the classics or thinking about some of these difficult issues that are facing the world, in my discipline, especially specifically when we talk about speech and debate, specifically debate, where students are forced to sometimes articulate a position with which they might disagree and to learn more about the opponent, this helps cultivate those critical thinking skills that sometimes we miss if we just have a quest for the right answer. So when students are participating in an activity like debate or in an activity like a classroom discussion where their preconceived ideas are challenged, that opens up the creativity. And in a field like yours with computer technology, I imagine that you can find technicians or people that are adequate or competent with the technology are probably a dime a dozen. But those content creators, those that know how to apply the technology in an innovative fashion, those are the ones that are moving the industry forward. And I think those are the types of people that a liberal arts education produces.
Absolutely. And, you know, I'd say so the cross-disciplinary effort is really one of the things that, you know, we've been talking about that. What's really interesting is that the reverse is also true. Computer science, as it's got grown and developed as a discipline and started formulating its sub-disciplines, you know, IT, cybersecurity, so on and so forth. CS plus X, where the X is another discipline, is now part of the what you should have in your curriculum as well. So the that outside idea of mixing other things together and mixing computing into other things has influenced the discipline as well. There's that recognition of you can be the best program on earth, but if nobody clicks the button on the left, they always click on the right. Yeah. You know, those sort of, you know, human computer interaction. One of those fascinating fields. It's not my area of study, but love looking at it. One of the really fun jobs I had for a brief period of time was director of data science at an e-commerce company, which reported to the marketing team. So a lot of what I did was marketing analytics, things like A-B testing, where you test the blue button, yellow button, which do people click on more? You know, okay, you're advertising, this ad works, this one doesn't. How people react to all of that can get really, really technical, but it can be also very, very subjective. Blue is great, red is bad, those elements. So understanding how to look at other areas definitely is one of the big benefits there. The example I always like to give, again, the whole five-year plan for majors is not necessarily a solid career path, but one benefit it did give me is I graduated with a history and political science degree. Like, all right, cool, because I kept taking those classes for fun. I was here 5 years. They pointed out I really should graduate someday. And then I went and got a job at Microsoft.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, how? Well, I did have a majority of a comm degree, good chunk of a CS degree, part of an MIS degree. But I was able to walk in and with that interview committee demonstrate that, well, yes, and how to apply this topic, talking with a variety of people. The customers don't always make sense when we're trying to troubleshoot their software. So
right.
The company that had this software is enterprise resource planning software, so could be doing anything. So the broad application definitely applied. Now, I do give the disclaimer of the four people on the interviewing committee, two were Jimmy alums. So said, oh, you had this class from this professor, accounting, for example. And I said, yep, all three semesters. There's two. If you take the first one twice, it counts as three. Apparently, homework needed to be turned in once in a while. I did better on my second round for that. But it also shows, though, how computer science or computing is being influenced by everything else. So you apply something to a thing. Well, that thing can apply itself on back, too. Where was it? Charleston, for example, they started working with technology in their music program, and then ended up with a whole music tech, probably a major. I don't remember the exact program, but not right. an area that I would have thought of mixing together. You know, sure, we use technology in music, you know, sound, light, so on and so forth to enhance shows and performances. But the mixing back and forth was just a really fascinating example of a liberal arts mix and unexpected outcomes to kind of mix those things together.
Absolutely. And I think you bring up a lot of good points. And by the way, for those of you that are tuning in, you're listening to Jimmy Office Hours. My name is Scott, along with my friend Jacob, and we both serve at the University of Jamestown, North Dakota. And we're having a conversation about the liberal arts. And we're going to take a short break. And on the other side of this break, we're going to continue our conversation. And Jacob, I want us to talk about some of the problems that the liberal arts is facing in the next few years, as well as I want to hear your answer to the objection that many students have, that I hear from a lot of students, and that's this idea on return on investment for a liberal arts education. So we'll come back with more of this conversation on liberal arts education on Jimmy Office Hours in just a moment. Stay tuned. And welcome back to Jimmy Office Hours. My name is Scott, along with my friend Jacob, and we are professors at the University of Jamestown, and we are both privileged to invest in the lives of students on a daily basis. Jacob in the discipline of computer technology, and I serve as a professor of communication studies and speech and debate coach. And Jacob, we certainly share a lot of praise for a liberal arts education, but I think we would be remiss if we didn't talk about some of the problems as well. As the liberal arts continue to evolve and change, I know that you and I, along with our colleagues, were having conversations about what belongs in the discipline of the liberal arts. And certainly you have that foundation that you articulated well in the last segment, going all the way back to Aristotle. And I often tell people that the reason that I teach at a private university, and the University of Jamestown is a private Christian university, is due to two people, right? Probably it was Aristotle and Jesus. So that's the reason why we are here as a institution of higher education from a Christian heritage perspective. But there are lots of conversations about the liberal arts when we talk about the canon, the classics that are taught, what belongs in the canon, and the fact that we do have issues that a lot of the classics that are read and taught in institutions of higher education, especially embracing the liberal arts, happen to be from dead white men. And so we know that in the world and in the culture, there are lots of other perspectives that we have yet to hear from. So moving forward, just sort of surveying the landscape when it comes to liberal arts education generally, what evolutions do you see taking place? What changes in your estimation need to take place, and what conversations do we need to have?
So I'll kind of start with the last one. Mm-hmm. The being willing to have conversations is one of the biggest challenges that we have. And I don't think it's a new one. Just based on notes that I've read from previous department chairs of meetings they had 20 years ago, whether or not IT was an appropriate discipline at a liberal art, appropriate major liberal arts institution, we're having the same arguments 20 years, but being able to have those conversations, because it really came out. So in my dissertation, I did qualitative, which meant, interviewing people and things like that. And it was focused on cybersecurity, but it really ended up being more broad, cybersecurity in liberal arts institutions. So interviewing faculty at liberal arts institutions from across the country, And when one thing became abundantly clear that I, the most shocking aspect of that was how much semantics made a difference. These days we can kind of, a little my bias coming out here, cybersecurity is a life skill. It's just a thing we need to be aware of and do. So did every university that I interviewed have some sort of cybersecurity in their curriculum? Absolutely. Did every university call it that? No. You'd have a university like ours, where we're like, yeah, we need a class of that. Student said so. We call ourselves a liberal arts orientated or liberal arts tradition career preparatory school, where one of the liberal arts schools I talked to out on the East Coast says, no, we don't call it that. We'd never get it through our curricular council and our faculty body. It sounds too career prep. We call it this. Same course, same outcomes. But so being willing, that just kind of floored me. I'm like, well, they won't even talk about it if it sounds too career prep. Nope. Okay. Here at least, we've had some certainly lively, passionate discussions on, for example, our gen ed curriculum. But we'll at least have those conversations and we might agree, disagree, win, lose, whatever you want it. So having that discourse, if we go back to the origins of liberal arts, that whole being able to have a discourse is one of the points. Even if we're shifting what we might encompass in a liberal arts based or inspired institution, we need to be able to have that civil discourse, which is so. But the civil discourse, that's kind of where I was going with that future problems. It's never been a great thing. I mean, yellow journalism and things like that has been a thing since, well, probably started putting things down on stone tablets. But technology has made it worse. And what I mean by that is things like social media. We might have a bad or sensational article or skewed or a great article that doesn't get blasted all over social media. So we get our news. And then we think about these algorithms. They are designed to show us things that we might like. So if we spend time looking at an article on one topic, you know what we see? More articles on that same topic. And then I'm sure you cover it in your comm classes and whatnot, about those whole echo chambers. They're e way easier to not accidentally blind in it. Where do we get some of our best outcomes, our best ideas? Those conflict of ideas where we see opposing viewpoints can discuss it. And so it becomes very, very difficult. Social media has just really escalated that in because it's far quicker and easier to share whatever our viewpoint is.
And you talk about those echo chambers, and it leads to confirmation bias, right? If you're living in a If you're living in an echo chamber and the algorithm starts feeding you what you want to hear and what you want to see, then you become convinced, right, through that fallacy of confirmation bias that your position is right. And I want to point out that just because we are college professors doesn't mean that we aren't susceptible to those same sorts of fallacies. And that's where the institution and the faculty have to come together and have those difficult conversations, because as someone who obviously has made a career out of coaching debate, I see great benefit in the clash of ideas. And one of the things that the echo chamber of social media doesn't provide us the opportunity to do is to have that pushback, meaningful pushback, where someone says, "No, I don't think you're right, and here's why." And one of the things that we endeavor, we don't always get it right, but we endeavor to train our students in when they are practicing the activity of debate, is you're not allowed to disagree with someone until you can first articulate their position to their satisfaction. And what that does, it helps you avoid the confirmation bias of assuming that you know what the other position is and setting up the straw man fallacy and knocking it over very easily. Because when you go through the hard work of attempting to understand the opposing position, a lot of times you realize, oh, we're not as far apart as I thought we were. And yes, this is an incredibly complex and difficult situation and circumstance and issue that we're trying to solve here. So maybe if we collaborate and work together, maybe we can solve this issue instead of trying to set up a competition of ideas that you're right and I'm right and you're wrong. And this is the problem that we see in our politics today in America.
Yeah, or you know, one of the examples that comes to mind is the playing the devil's advocate.
Right.
Part of it. Got an individual on there who loves to do this. Generally for very good reason. Did we think an idea all the way through? Well, what if, what could go wrong? And with technology, that's one of the skills we really, we tend to be very poor at in computing is what could go wrong? You know, adding it, making the passwords tougher and things like that. You know, let's put Wi-Fi in it. We figure that out before that. Fortunately, it's still popular enough that some of my students get the reference. But the old Jurassic Park, well, you know, whether or not we could before whether or not we should,
right.
That's definitely, you know, technology. It's nothing new, but hopefully students coming out of our institutions are doing that second, third, fourth. Well, okay, how could somebody misuse that? Take some of the AI generation. Do you have a wild guess at some of the first things that got disabled in AI generating tool? Inappropriate images.
Yeah. Okay.
Why? What's one of the first things that the internet facilitates? Inappropriate usage, right?
In fact, so, that was the application that pushed the technology forward, if I remember correct.
Absolutely. Yeah. One of it. Or just people like to see if they can break stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Cortana, Microsoft solution. The first rendition of that as a chatbot online, years and years ago, before they built it into Windows, it took less than an hour for the internet to turn it into a wildly racist chatbot.
Mm, wow.
So, but hey, we thought, can we do this? And let's see what happens.
Mm-hmm.
We need to ask those questions. We need to have that debate. So I come up with this great app that's going to solve all of the problems for tracking liberal arts things. Having a discussion with you and we're like, well, yeah, but could you use it for something else? Okay, you switched what track my thinking is on.
Right.
And those are the sort of skills that we really, really need to be pushing regardless of what our discipline is. Technology, we can pick on it all day long with AI, because it seems like every day there's a new article coming out of how something went wrong with AI or Microsoft's Bing is gonna world domination was its answer, whatever the scenario is. Okay, well, we need to have these discussions. Is that a problem?
Yeah, you're exactly right, because that's one of the skills that we endeavor to teach in debate is when you're on the negation, when you're not advocating for a particular position, your job is to poke holes, right, in the affirmative's position. So they're affirming the resolution or they're proposing a plan with all of these benefits and something that the affirmative, obviously it's not their job to do so, but it is the job of the negation to bring up unintended consequences.
Yeah.
And when you can work through those unintended consequences, and as the affirmation, if you're advocating for this position, if you're going to represent your position well and in a persuasive manner, then you need to anticipate what those objections are going to be and have a good answer for those unintended consequences of this great thing that you're proposing. And I think a liberal arts education, when applied and practiced well, cultivates that sort of thinking.
Absolutely. One of the other examples that kind of comes to mind for this is I didn't really get it till years later, but I had a manager when I was an IT help desk admin that always insisted you bring him three solutions to a problem. which, well, okay, you know, antivirus or whatever the case is. No, I found the solution. This is what we should use. No, you find me two others and how they could also work. So that really became a challenge because, well, you decide on the solution. You've got the pros and cons for this. You know, why do I need to think that hard about these other things? Well, by exploring different avenues, whether or not you agree with them, you find more evidence for this is right, but the cost or whatever the scenario is, you further emphasize why the path you pick, but you understand it better. And it took me probably the whole year of working with that guy to really get why he did that. I always said it was, I just need three things and you give me three, we pick the right. Okay, fine, we'll pick three. You know, and some things it was that straightforward. You put the effort into one and you're like, well, it's so clear that we could do this or this, but we're not really going to bother explaining that. Yep, that's fine. But it still, it forced you to do that. What's the next step? And so if we kind of circle back around to what's the problem with a student handing in a chat GPT generated speech or assignment, a chunk of code? Well, did they think about the next steps? You look through it and you know the tools aren't quite there yet where it doesn't plug the different sections very well through. And so have you thought this all the way through? And what's the next steps? That the computers aren't very good at yet.
Right. Absolutely. And that's why this sort of education is needed to help students think through the implications of new technology. And speaking of students, we've got a few moments left in our time together today and Jimmy office hours. So I wanted to ask you this question because I hear this objection a lot. We're starting to hear it from politicians in the United States. And certainly I think we can all agree that the cost of higher education is out of control. And that certainly is a problem that needs to be addressed in our nation. But what you're hearing from a lot of students and their families today is that the cost of a liberal arts education doesn't equal the benefit. And so students are asking, what is my return on investment? I'm here to learn a skill or to learn a particular set of knowledge and information that I can apply in the world so that I can get a job, so that I can make a comfortable living. So why do I have to read that book? Why do I have to make that speech? Why do I have to think through these particular problems if they don't apply to what I want to do in the real world?
Yeah, so we've got a few things stacking together and then some of the classic examples of years and years of a rhetoric of, I did my education, I paid for it just fine, from older generations where it was a tenth of the cost. And so, you know, we don't make that adjustment. And then decades of career counselors, secondary ed counselors saying college is the only way to go. And probably unintentionally devaluing anything else.
Right.
So that whole concept, I'm a failure if I don't do this. So then we've got the, you know, 20, 30 years of students who there is a percentage that don't graduate, go for a little bit out of crude debt, have felt it's worthless. And these aren't silent people, nor should they be. Mm-hmm. And so you get this out there that, well, I did a bit of college and it didn't benefit me, but I lined up with a lot of debt.
Yeah.
And so we're not necessarily comparing apples to apples here, but that is the, I paid for mine. I got a lot of debt, nothing out of it. That's some of the groundwork we've developed the last 20, 30 years. And now with politics, we've got a rise in, I think it's best being described as anti-intellectualism.
Yes.
The, you know, try not to go down that rabbit hole too far, but, you know, sensationalist, social media, the college has become a consumer-driven thing. Mm-hmm. I want my immediate gratification. I paid for this, I get this. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, higher ed in general is like, that's not quite how it works, buddy. Right. But we will add some extra things because we want you to keep us going here. So liberal arts, we typically don't do a very good job at selling the immediate gratification. It's there. You can immediately leave here and apply your thing to anything. Exactly. That's one of the things I tell prospective students. You know, you can leave here and you can get a job as a programmer, but you want to be the barista who's keeping the Wi-Fi going.
Mm-hmm.
You're capable of doing that too. Whatever. Right. And so that flexibility, if we're going to boil down liberal arts to one word, which is pretty much impossible, but I'd use the term flexibility. You know, that broad base, we can apply our thing to anything. So pick a random major here at UJ. How many different names could we give that program? You know, computer science, is it computer science, is it software engineering, so on and so forth? Yep, could be any of those, depending on how you plug your elements together and interface with other things out there. So our graduates aren't qualified for just one thing. Now, these days we have to compete against trade schools. And that sounds kind of odd, but that's our 20, 30 years of baggage of rhetoric devaluing those when college is not necessarily for everybody. Boy, did I waste a buttload of money being here 5 years, taking history classes for fun, knowing that I probably wasn't going to get a history job.
Yeah.
So that's that also the traditional, you know, oh, you just take basket weaving courses. It seems like I wasted my time doing that when I put it that way, right?
Right.
I took all these history classes and I didn't do a job in them. But what did those history classes teach me?
Exactly.
Teach me the different areas. So I was able to go into somewhere and say, no, you should hire me. Mm-hmm. And then from, you know, a few months at Microsoft, then I ended up being a consultant. Right. Getting paid to fly around the country and work on their software, and so on and so forth. That the how you apply your education is something immediate that you can do as soon as you leave here or even while you're here. And right. We don't always do a good job at selling that. We sell where we are, a little bit who we are, our identity. The community aspect, University of, we do wonderful at selling that part. And those are all absolutely true, wonderful things. That's how we recruit students here. But emphasizing the outcomes, here's what you could do when you leave. We're not always the best at that. And so that whole thing going, that's the other thing I always see online, particularly with computer science or technology-related majors, is as soon as you learn that, it's dated. Or they're teaching programming languages from 5 years ago. And then, you know what? Some of that's absolutely true. Mm-hmm. Professor Sand has been here since the 80s, was my professor as a student here more than 20 years ago, and is still teaching the same programming language, C++. But it's not about the programming language.
Right.
The whole point of that introductory programming course sequence that he teaches, he could teach Python, whatever, a different programming. It doesn't matter. It's what is the process? What is the thought process behind what you're doing? Mm-hmm. How do you apply that thought process elsewhere? I know we're running short on time, but, you know, just to pull an example from continuing that on, I'd been at the large aerospace company, 6-7 years at that point,
right.
And got asked to fix a report. Going through the code, I spent about 3-4 days going through it, getting very mad at the person who'd originally done it. There was chunks that were done weird, incorrect, but no notes anywhere. Mm-hmm. And one of the things Professor Sand always harps on is documenting your stuff. And I'm like, wow, this client clearly never had a classroom, just mad. Fifth day, I finally get to about the end of it. I think I fixed all the stuff. I found some notes at the very end. They were signed by me. It had been my work from 4 years before.
Yeah.
I'd finally been at the company long enough to have forgotten some of my old work. And I'm like, oh, so this person did actually have a class and he had not applied the lesson that was from the class properly in his career. And you know what? It's been a little bit better ever since that thing.
Yeah.
But so how do you apply things to other things is a really, really vague sentence. But if we're getting one thing out of liberal arts and selling that thing, we're also in a media gratification society. Right. I want my level up. I want my gamification. We have it. We just don't sell it. It's the, you know, we talk about the lifelong contributor to society. Over the course of your life, getting a college degree will make you X number of dollars more. The studies are there. The research are there that shows that's still true. Mm-hmm. But that doesn't help me when I graduate and that bill comes due in 6-12 right. months, whatever it is. And you look at it, you're like, wow, that's a really big number. And you're looking at your paycheck and you're like, who's FICA? And why was I robbed? You know, when you compare those numbers, that doesn't help.
Right.
But what can we do with that? How can we change it? Yeah. We have a lot of options when we're graduating with a liberal arts degree. So,
yeah. And I think that's well said. And I think a lot of this comes from generations where we have been convinced here in the United States and even globally that the pathway to success is a specialist.
Yeah.
Whereas I think the future has changed, and even the present is demonstrating that the day of the specialist is bygone. And what you need to do now is be a generalist, perhaps have a specialist knowledge and skill set, but then have a generalist where you can walk into any situation, into any circumstance, and speak intelligently on a variety of subjects to a particular person and share that information with them. For instance, if you are a plumber, right? Absolutely a needed skill set in our world today. But the customer base and the clientele that you're able to serve might be limited if you don't have a general application of knowing how to speak intelligently to a variety of people from a variety of backgrounds. Can you sell your services effectively and charge a premium based upon what you know and what you understand about the changing world? And so when we talk about return on investment, that is what a liberal arts education offers the student, is that you emerge from the institution not only with a specialty skill set that you can apply to make money in a specific sector, but the application, as you talked about beautifully, being able to go into a variety of worlds and be effective and successful in those worlds.
I would also say, though, too, that it's not just those variety of things that we can do, wider variety of things that we can do. It's also recognition of limitations. Mm-hmm. We have had exposures to things that we have not done well. And so you're going to go start your business. You've discovered that coding, you absolutely loathe coding. You might be able to do all the graphics, keep all the computers running, but coding, you loathe it. Right, okay. Are you going to do that for your business? Or are you going to try to find somebody and be able to have the knowledge to vet them, work with them? You'll build your team based on your limitations, because no matter how independent and introverted we are, part of being a society is you're going to have to interact with people somehow, some way. And so knowing your limitations, getting exposed to things that maybe I'm not the best at that,
right,
is something we're also doing. We don't necessarily talk about that as much either, but those barriers, those limitations, exposure to ideas that make us uncomfortable. Failure makes us uncomfortable. But I'll tell you, I learned the most about management the year I was editor-in-chief of the Collegian here, because I did everything wrong. Or I did a lot of things wrong. I did not manage. I was, instead of an editing, I was more of a manager. Mm-hmm. And managing people. I carried the lessons from that year forward into any job as a team lead, so on and so forth. I learned a lot of things by not doing it right.
Right.
And that's additionally what we're conveying here.
Yeah. And that gives you an opportunity as a student here in a safe space where the stakes aren't as high as they will be in the work world, where you can fail and you can fail effectively, because you're exactly right. We do learn the most from our mistakes. Well, Jacob, this has been a delightful conversation, and we're not finished. We're going to continue this in future episodes of Jimmy Office Hours. And do me a favor, if you like the content, if you benefit from the content, share this podcast with a friend or family member, or perhaps a prospective student who is considering coming to the University of Jamestown or continuing their education in some other institution of higher education. Share and subscribe to our podcast, and we appreciate you doing that. So, Jacob, thank you very much, and we'll see you on the next episode of Jimmy Office Hours.
Absolutely. Thank you.
This has been Jimmy Office Hours, where academics talk about academics. If you enjoyed the program, be sure to like, share, subscribe, and rate our program. We'll see you next time on Jimmy Office Hours.